My next guest has just completed a pretty rigorous history of the Ulster Volunteer Force with unprecedented and frankly baffling levels of access to the leading members of one of the world's most ruthless paramilitary groups. He conducted meticulous interviews with members including David Irvine and Billy Mitchell. The book delves into the background of a litany of high-profile atrocities such as the Dublin and Monaghan bombings and the Shankill Butchers serial killing spree. Aaron Edwards, author of UVF Behind the Mask, you are very welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
You did get really good access. How did you get these guys to trust you enough that they would talk?
Well, that's a good question. I have a long history of having grown up in Belfast and having studied various aspects of the Troubles. And, of course, knowing many of the leading members, not just of the UVF, but of their political associates in the PUP, in the Progressive Unionist Party, of course, which has many of the former members of the UVF in the party. And through the close association with them and with one of the former leading members of the UVF, Billy Mitchell, I was able to conduct research, quite rigorous research, well over 10 years ago, that actually went out to their membership for consultation. So they were in an internal consultation process then, and I fed into that in my analysis.
Something unfortunate happened when you were writing this, which was the Boston Tapes scandal, which I suppose made it more difficult to convince people to talk to you, given that there was a question of prosecutions arising out of what was on those Boston tapes that were never supposed to see the light of day. What was the reaction of the UVF subjects during that time?
Quite understandably, they were hesitant. People were hesitant to continue talking to me. I think that what I made clear was that people should not incriminate themselves in any way, shape or form. I wasn't particularly interested in finding out who people were that I was talking to. I mean, it's not like anyone actually ever said I was in the UVF. Some people
in Northern Ireland, people got very good at dancing around that kind of thing.
Well, I think journalists especially, but also academics. And you'll find that in the book, actually, a large number of people interviewed were anonymous and wished to remain anonymous. I have no idea who some of these people are. People will just have to take it on trust and long years of experience as an academic that they are telling me at least something true in the general sense. So I rely on documentary sources as much as interviews and the public record. So there is a huge amount of available material out there in the form of newspapers and public records.
We were talking with an earlier guest about the further you get away from dark points in history, the less people remember. And there is an entire generation in Northern Ireland now, and we say this with happiness, that don't know, don't remember what went on. And not that I'd forgotten the Shankill Butchers, but it had been stored in a part of my brain that I hadn't gone to in a while. Remind us of who they were and what they did.
Well, the Shankill Butchers gang, that was a term that was given by journalists much later, of course. They were a part of a UVF unit on the Shankill Road. UVF units at that particular time met in public houses and various other places, but they were known as the Brown Bear Team, and they were led by people like Lenny Murphy, who is well known, but also other people, William Moore, for example, who was a close associate of Lenny Murphy's. And of course, that's detailed in best-selling work by Martin Dillon, the Shankill Butchers. And so the story is very well known, but what's not well known is actually or well understood. And what I've tried to bring to the history of that particular episode is why these individuals did what they did. Because and I think that comes across quite clearly in the book, that what we're actually dealing with here are ordinary people. It's shocking, I know, for some people to hear that, but we have people who, under normal circumstances, would not have become involved in political violence.
They killed nationalists and unionists alike. The argument could be made they were the worst serial killers that the island has ever seen. And they were declared by a psychiatrist to be sane. How can you commit that level of atrocity, that level of violence against often innocent people, never mind people involved in the process, and be sane?
Well, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I have looked at the work of psychologists on this matter. I've talked to psychologists about the individuals, and well, it's a complicated process. I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't say that. And what I mean by complicated process is that if you are not dealing with people who can be quite clearly identified as psychopaths, then how is it that they do what they do? Well, you have to look at the organisation of the UVF. The structure itself is quite revealing, that they have a code of silence, a code of honour. They certainly did during the Troubles, when a lot of the violence was carried out.
The other side would have had a code of amerta. It was something similar.
Absolutely, yes. And what the UVF also had was it styled itself along quite antiquated, actually, British Army lines. So you had people like Gusty Spence, who became a figurehead, an icon for the UVF in the 1970s, and he would have been responsible for reorganising the UVF. And they had an internal disciplinary process, which meant that if you read the statements of the Shankill Butchers, of the Brown Bear team, when they are apprehended in the late 1970s, a lot of them will say, well, we can't reveal who was involved with us because there are consequences there. And so the internal disciplinary process, the obedience to the authority, is something that comes across quite clearly in their statements.
You describe an undisclosed assassination attempt on Martin McGuinness. This was when?
Well, it's difficult when you're dealing with people who... you know, their memories aren't as sharp, perhaps, and so it may be bravado, but I've dated it to 1990, but certainly 1990-91.
So that recent, so around just before Good Friday Agreement.
Absolutely, and I think that there is a history of loyalist paramilitaries trying to assassinate senior Republican figures such as Gerry Adams in 1984. Where the Ulster Freedom Fighters, another organisation, tried to kill him in Belfast City Centre. And, of course, Michael Stone, who was affiliated to the UFF, carried out an attack on Milltown Cemetery in 1988. So there is a history there. And Mr McGuinness and others, who I mentioned in the book, were targeted by...
But it never went ahead. Did you find out why it never went ahead?
Well, this is a great unanswered question, and it is very difficult to infer a right or wrong answer. But clearly, there is evidence of individuals who may have been going to carry out certain attacks where they have been arrested and imprisoned by the police. So one would imagine that you have a preventative process in place by the security forces to stop that. That might be one aspect of it. Another could be that they simply called it off for whatever internal reason.
Billy Mitchell was probably the most senior UVF leader that people will remember. And he became part of the solution in Northern Ireland, despite
Absolutely.
His background. Went on to be involved in cross-community projects, went on to be involved in ensuring there was disarmament, and members of the UVF were not reformed, but I suppose reintegrated. There were two sides to that, Matt, and in many ways that was Northern Ireland in a nutshell, that somebody who was capable of terrible evil was also capable of remarkable good. Can you explain that transition in him?
I can. For the first time ever, I managed to speak to people who interacted with him in the prison system. He was a remarkable man. I'm by no means neutral on Billy Mitchell. I knew him personally, and he was absolutely dedicated to peace and reconciliation without any equivocation whatsoever. He wanted to give back what he believed he had taken away in his earlier involvement. Now, he is an interesting character because he became involved with UVF and this conspiracy, which had sprung out of certain elements within the right wing of the Unionist Party in the mid-60s. So his history starts in the mid-60s, involvement in this loyalist militancy, and carries on through to 1970, becomes a senior member of the UVF and one of their most ruthless units, East Antrim UVF. By mid-1970s, he's on the brigade staff, so he's one of the most senior members of the UVF. And he's apprehended, he's captured, he goes on the run for about 6 months, and he's captured in March 1976 and then imprisoned. And he goes through this metamorphosis where you have, he's wrestling constantly with his conscience. He comes into contact with Gussie Spence, who sets him off in this journey of self-discovery. And as is well known, people like Billy Hutchison, currently the leader of the PUP, David Irvine, others, who where they interact in prison, and they actually do something that's positive. They lay the foundation for what becomes their contribution to the peace process, and Billy Mitchell's absolutely in the centre of that. By the 1980s, he rejects violence. He comes to reject violence, and one of the reasons for that that he gives, and I've looked at his prison writings, I've had access to those, is that he hears of the Provisional IRA killing of Mary Travers in Belfast, and where there is an assassination attempt on her father, who's a judge, and that's the defining moment for him, where he says this could have been someone in my family, and so he comes to reject political violence, and from then on, in the mid 1980s through to his release in 1990, he essentially charts what becomes his legacy, which is cross-community work.
And quite the legacy it is as well. Aaron, you're an academic, you've written this book, you've spoken to these guys. All that's going on in Northern Ireland right now, talk about threats to the peace process, could we end up going back there? I take it from what you're saying that these guys are out of the game, that no more than the Provisional IRA as they were, they're firmly committed on the road to peace. There's no chance the UVF are coming back. Did you get a sense that something could happen that would reinvigorate, I won't say that passion, but that aggression that was so omnipresent in the 60s and 70s?
Well, first of all, it's my belief, talking to people connected to the UVF, that they are absolutely committed to the peace process. And I think that, they have gone through quite a rocky road where, in terms of contribution to the peace process in the early 1990s, which was by no means something that the media gave them credit for. They did. They were responsible for considerable violence and death and destruction. But by the 1990s, they were prepared to enter into dialogue. And of course, it's interesting, sitting in Dublin, that they chose to enter into dialogue with the Irish government before the British government, which is remarkable. But I think that there's a maturity, there's a level of maturity in the ranks of the UVF, but also in terms of the Irish government as was, through the good work of Chris Hudson, who is, of course, a trade unionist figure now, minister in Belfast, they were able to reach a point where they called a ceasefire. And I think that they've had some difficulty in trying to run down the sort of more militant membership, which of course are there in small numbers. But I think that the latest assessment in 2015 was that the leadership was committed to a transformation process.
Okay, the old boys club still there and still in charge. Aaron Edwards, author of UVF Behind the Mask, is published by Merriam Press. It is in shops now. Very good. Okay, Aaron, pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much
for joining
us.
Jonathan.